For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
So, the beast, it's the Antichrist, as some people call him. Revelation never quite uses that term, though. It calls him the beast. There's really three beasts. There's the beast from the abyss, that was the dragon. Last week, we saw the dragon pursuing the woman with child and all that sort of thing. It was Satan. Then there's the beast from the sea, which is the guy we're after this week. He is human, but probably, well, he's controlled by, empowered by, maybe possessed by Satan himself. And then we'll see there's a third beast, the beast from the land. So we'll be getting to all of these. This is what you call the unholy trinity or the trinity of hell. And I'll talk a bit about that later. Okay, here's how what we're going to do. We're going to read whole sections here of this passage and two other passages that are relevant to this subject. And we're going to read the whole passages through so you can get the flow of thought. And pay close attention to the wording, phraseology, because it's like almost word for word. And you can tell that they're linked to each other because of the literary dependence there. And then we're going to go side by side and just line them up and see how they synchronize. And that we come to realize that the web that prophecy is given down as like a web, like a woven tapestry. And that when you see... start connecting all of the synchronous points, then the whole picture takes shape and it protects you from misinterpreting the passage. So if you just interpret one passage in isolation and say, well, I think it means this and so forth, you know, you could easily be wrong on that. But when you see these same threads going through multiple correlating passages and the contexts are the same too, then you know that you're right on top of it. And so it's a way to prevent bad interpretation of Scripture interpreting itself, self-interpreting text. Okay, this phrase, some of your Bibles has at the end of 11, some have it at the beginning of 12. And I know what the confusion is, where the chapter break is. The dragon took his stand on the shore beside the sea. So here he's sitting there and looking out. We read in verse 1 of 13, then I saw a beast rise up out of the sea. It had seven heads and 10 horns with 10 crowns on its horns. And written on each head were names that blasphemed God. This beast looked like a leopard and had the feet of a bear and the mouth of a lion. And the dragon gave the beast his own power and a throne and a great authority. I saw that one of the heads of the beast seemed wounded beyond recovery, but the fatal wound was healed. The whole world marveled at this miracle and gave allegiance to the beast. They worshiped the dragon for giving the beast such power, and they also worshiped the beast. Who is as great as the beast, they claimed? Who is able to fight against him? Then we read the beast was allowed to speak great blasphemies against God, and he was given authority to do whatever he wanted for 42 months. There's that number again. And he spoke terrible words of blasphemy against God, slandering his name and his dwelling, that is, those who dwell in the heaven. And the beast was allowed to wage war against God's holy people and to conquer them. And he was given authority to rule over every tribe and people and language and nation. It's a worldwide rule by this beast. Now, here's a parallel passage in Rev 17. A scarlet beast with seven heads and 10 horns shows up again in this chapter. This time it's being ridden by a woman. So we'll study this when we get to it, but I think this particular section is important to look at next to 13 because it explains what the horns and the heads are. Okay, he says, the angel that's talking to John says, here's the mind which has wisdom. The seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman sits, and they're seven kings. Five have fallen, one is, the other is not yet come, and when he comes, he must remain a little while. Well, the beast which you saw, which was and is not, is himself also an eighth, and is one of the seven, and he goes to destruction. The ten horns, which you saw, are ten kings who have not yet received a kingdom, but they receive authority as kings with the beast for an hour, for 1 hour. These have one purpose. They give their power and authority to the beast. Okay, so there's two passages. Here's a third passage. In this one, we're going back to way back to Old Testament times. Now we're back to 500 and some BC. Prophet Daniel, dream, a vision, and it's about beasts. See, notice the language. I was looking in my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of heaven were stirring up the great sea. So it comes out of the sea, just like before. In his case, though, there's four great beasts coming up from the sea, different from one another. The first was like a lion and had the wings of an eagle. The second, behold, I'm gonna skip through this because it's just too long to read the whole thing, but I'm giving you the crux of it. And behold, another beast, a second one resembled a bear. Then there's a third one that looks like a leopard. It turns out these are the successive empires that are going to be coming in the future. The one he's in now, the Babylonian Empire, the one that comes after that, the Persian Empire, and the one that defeated the Persian Empire, which is Alexander the Great and the Neo-Grecian Empire. That's the leopard. After this, I kept looking at the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast, dreadful, terrifying, extremely strong. It had large iron teeth, the hardest metal they knew at that time. This is, you know, like iron, hard. It devoured and crushed and trampled down the remainder with its feet, and it was different from all the other beasts that were before it. And it had 10 horns. Whoa. Yeah. While I was contemplating the horns, behold, another horn, a little one, came up among them. Three of the first horns were pulled out by the roots before it. And behold, this horn had possessed eyes like the eyes of a man and a mouth uttering great boasts. So the little horn of Daniel, he calls it a little horn that grew up. Subsequent, the ten were already there. And then comes this little horn. It's a dude. He's got the eyes of a man. It's not, it seems to be hinting that this is actually a guy uttering great boasts. Remember those phrases and terms. Then I kept looking because of the sound of the boastful words which the horn was speaking. I kept looking until the beast was slain and its body was destroyed and given to the burning fire. I kept looking in the night visions, and behold, with the clouds of heaven, one like a son of man was coming, and he came up to the Ancient of Days and was presented before him. It's Christ. This is where Jesus got his title. He always called himself the Son of Man. It's right in that verse right there. And to him was given dominion, glory, and a kingdom that all the peoples, nations, and men of every language might serve him. And he says his dominion is an everlasting dominion which will not pass away, and his kingdom is one which will not be destroyed. So you see the contrast between all of these passing empires, successive, succeeding one another, destroying one another. But this is an empire. This is a world rule kingdom that will never be destroyed. Well, later in the chapter, he asks the revealing angel to explain some of it. And so we get it interpreted to us by the angel. He says, I desire to know the exact meaning of the fourth beast, which was different from all the others, and the meaning of the 10 horns that were on his head, and the other horn which came up, which had the eyes and mouth and uttering great boasts. Well, he said, I kept looking, and that horn was waging war with the saints and overpowering them until the Ancient of Days, it's God, came and judgment was passed in favor of the saints of the highest one, and the time arrived when the saints took possession of the kingdom. Thus, he said, the fourth beast will be a fourth kingdom on the earth, which will be different from all the other kingdoms, and which will devour the whole earth and tread it down and crush it. It's Rome. I can't give you the full case for that for the sake of time, but it's definitely Rome. The succession of empires is unmistakable. Every aspect of the description of this fits Rome. including the fact that it's so much more dominant than any of the ones before it. There never had been an empire like Rome in terms of the control they wielded, in terms of the size that they were, and in terms of the longevity, like 1,200 years of rule. There's never been anything like it before or since. And this is the fourth beast. As for the ten horns, out of this kingdom, ten kings will arise, and another after them. So out of this kingdom, it's kind of a weird way to express that. You would think it within this kingdom or something like this, but it's out of this kingdom, ten kings will arise, and another will arise after them, and he will be different from the previous ones and will subdue three of those kings. Okay, this ten kings, the ten horns, a beast with ten horns, it's pretty unusual. Really, there's no animal on earth that is like a beast with ten horns. There's no such thing. And so you have a beast with ten horns in Daniel 7. You have a beast with ten horns in Revelation 13. I don't think that's coincidental. I think those... And then we saw that in Revelation, this beast with ten horns is still in the future and comes with the beast. They're kings that reign with the beast. Well, back here, and it kind of pictures it the same way here, him rising up within that collection. Yeah, that's the little horn. Right there, between those two verses, I think, you have a prophetic gap. It's where it jumps from one period of history to another period. And what it shows is that Rome, which was this incredible empire, the dream of humanity to reign, to be supreme, you know, it's like not even just a king, but an empire, king of kings. It's a big theme here in Daniel. Rome was the supreme example of that. And somewhere in this narrative, we span time from Daniel's own day in the Babylonian Empire in 500 BC to the end of history with the coming of the one like a son of man who takes over the world and rules it forever. So somewhere in this narrative, we have jumped the tracks and fast forwarded. And where it is right here. And as so often the case with the prophetic gap, because the prophet would see the events, but not gaps of time in between. What's the gap? Involves the distance between the first and the second coming of Christ. That's the gap right there. You're going from events at the first coming of Christ directly to events right before the second coming. So there is a gap here somewhere. And people could debate, where is it? But I think this is where it is, because this ten horn thing hasn't happened yet. There is no ten Caesars. There's no way to sort through all those many more Caesars than that in the Roman Empire. There's no way to identify ten of them that somehow stand out. And in fact, they haven't come yet, because the little horn is Daniel's version of the beast, and he hasn't come. So none of that in verse 24 has happened yet. In 25, we read that he will speak out against the Most High and wear down the saints of the Highest One, and he will intend to make alterations in times and law, and they will be given into his hand for a time, times, and half a time. Well. So we saw that last week. That's not a normal way to say 3.5 years. That's a real synchronizing point. Okay, so speaking out about the Most High in times and half a time. But the court will sit for judgment. His dominion will be taken away, annihilated, and destroyed forever. It's the end of history as we know it. Okay, now let's go side by side and go back through these. And just notice here in Revelation 13, you notice the features of the beast that he sees coming out. The ten horns, seven heads, ten crowns, kind of like a leopard, kind of like a bear, kind of like a lion. Compare that to Daniel 3. They both come up out of the sea. That's the same. Daniel's first beast was like a lion. Whoa, His second beast was like a bear. His third beast was like a leopard. Here again now, so in Revelation, these are kind of all wrapped into one. And maybe we're kind of getting the message here that this last great empire that dominates the world will be like a summary, a realization of what all the parts always longed to be, you know, aspired to be, but now it's kind of like all bundled into one. But again, I don't think this is coincidental. I think that this is showing us these passages are linked. And then the fourth beast, as we read in verse 7, had 10 horns. And so again, I don't think that is coincidence either. These two passages clearly relate to each other. And so what I was talking about at the beginning, the correlation, the fabric, when we start seeing a few of these things line up, then we can line up the whole thing and realize they're both illuminating each other, these passages. Now, reading on in Rev 13, I saw that one of the heads of the beast had been wounded beyond recovery, but the fatal wound was healed. The whole world marveled at that. Seven heads, one of them wounded. Now let's line that up with 17. Okay, that other passage, the third passage we read, second one, whatever, it explains the heads, right? The seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman sits. Mountains, not hills. If you have certain translations, they translate seven hills. Or also as mountain, not hill. Georg Kittel, Greek authority, never is translated hill, always is translated mountain. The reason people translate it as hill is because they want this to be the seven hills of Rome. They want to identify this beast as Rome. It's an interpretation that goes back to the Reformation with the bitter outrage that the Reformers felt toward the Catholic Church. To them, the beast was the Pope, the Catholic Church. And it sits on the seven hills, which is the seven hills of Rome. Also, another thread that believes in this theory is liberal interpreters who say that basically the whole book of Revelation is just a coded message that Rome sucks and God's going to get them back for what they've done to us. And that's also the view of a third school called the preterist interpretation. All of them are wrong. And this is an unwarranted translation where we're actually translating the word improperly to fit with our view. If you've ever been to Rome, the seven hills of Rome are hard to even see. They're gentle rises and irregularities. There's like one of them that's you know, pretty noticeable. The others are just like very gentle. There are no mountains in Rome. It's not about Rome. And that should be obvious because they're not just the seven mountains. There are also seven kings. In fact, in apocalyptic literature, mountains regularly stand for a seat of power. And these are parallel. They're obviously the same thing. So that's just to say this is Rome is just bad interpretation. It's not Rome. There are seven kings. And he gives these details. Five have fallen. One is, and the other has not yet come. Okay, now putting ourselves in the time of writing around 90 AD, 95 AD. The beast, which was and is not, is himself also an eighth and is one of the seven. So which is it? Is it an eighth or is it one of its both? Okay. And he goes to destruction. Now, here's how it falls out. Compare it with what these are. The seven heads are the seven empires that have dominated and ruled, had held power over Israel throughout the Old Testament. The first one was Egypt. They held the Jews in slavery for 400 years until in the book of Exodus they escaped. Next was Assyria. They invaded Israel. They completely obliterated the northern kingdom of Israel and exported their population. They also invaded and sacked most of the southern Judah, the southern kingdom as well. Very destructive, very bad. Then you have Babylonia, which came and captured the rest of the Jewish people and carried them away as slaves into Babylon. Okay, after that, came the Persian Empire, took over from the Babylonians, and so the Jews became their slaves. But they then relented at a certain point and let them go back home. Then you have the Grecian Empire. This is following the same sequence that you see in the book of Daniel. And finally, when we're writing now, in 90 AD, all five of those are all past tense because we're now in the Roman period, right? This line here is where Daniel was writing. Daniel doesn't mention the first two because they were already past when he wrote. He was writing in the Babylonian period, so he just goes from Babylon forward, which makes sense because he was looking at the future. He wasn't looking at history. Here, we're looking past. We're looking back. Five have already fallen. And so, that's the first five heads right there. One is, it's Rome. Now is, in AD 90. That's that head. So we're up to six heads. The seventh head would be that prophetic gap that we saw in Daniel 7, where he went from the Roman Empire to this later thing, which is basically a reappearance of a new version of the Roman Empire. It's like the Roman Empire was there, and it disappears, and then it comes back. That is the one yet to come. It's a reappearance of the Roman Empire made up of a ten-nation grouping, a cluster of 10 kings that have power with the beast. Yeah, so that then is probably your fatal head wound right there, isn't it? A lot of people say, well, this head wound to the head that's a mortal wound is probably that the beast dies and arises from the dead in imitation of Jesus. But according to 17 here, it's actually the heads are kingdoms, and that kingdom perished, the Roman Empire perished, disappeared. And then it comes back. And people are astonished that that's possible, and they follow after the beast for that reason. Yeah, probably. Ooh, 13:3. Yeah, I saw one of the heads of the beast seem beyond recovery, but the fatal wound was healed. Let's keep reading up to verse 4. They worshiped the dragon for giving the beast such power, and they also worshiped the beast. Who is as great as the beast? Who can fight war with him? Some of your translation, who can make war with the beast or who can fight against him? Probably literally should be make war. Let's throw in a fourth passage while we're at it. Getting complicated. 2 Thessalonians 2, the man of lawlessness. It's on the same guy. Okay, now we're Paul writing 2 Thessalonians 2. He says, when he's revealed the son of destruction who opposes and exalts himself above every so-called god or object of worship so that he takes his seat in the temple of God displaying himself as being God. Right there. Dead ringer. They're worshiping the beast. Some people have speculated this proskuneo, this word could mean to just prostrate yourself, to submit yourself to the beast. But I think it's probably more religious. I think somehow he's able to convince people that he's divine. Something many rulers throughout history have done. That's kind of jarring to us as moderns to think of somebody being viewed as like God. Maybe it's rhetoric that he's gotten in touch with the God within like we all can or something. I don't know. But yeah. He does it. Who is able to fight against him? Who's able to make war with the beast? He must have tremendous, unassailable military power. And it's just so what we find is that the entire earth is intimidated by this entity, this power. They're just too strong to fight against. Well, keep reading verse 5 and 6. Then the beast was allowed to speak great blasphemies against God. Let's get Daniel 7:25 up here. Well, he will speak out against the Most High. He was allowed to speak blasphemies against God. Down here again. And he spoke terrible words of blasphemy against God, slandering his name. He will intend to make alterations in time and in law, and they will be given into his hand for a time and half a time. Oh, he was given authority to do whatever he wanted for 42 months. You see how tightly these line up? It's the same dude. It's the same empire in both. 42 months is 3.5 years. So is time times and half a time is a year, 2 years, and half a year. Third verse 7, and the beast was allowed to wage war against God's holy people and to conquer them. Oh, just like he wear down the saints of the highest one, make war with him, conquer them, is dead ringer. Of course, in the case of Daniel's little horn, God interrupts human history during his reign with the coming of Christ and the takeover of the world. In the case of the beast, we'll find when we get to chapter 19 and 20, during his reign, God does the same thing. So we have a lock. We know exactly who this is. It's well taught, not just in the ones we've read tonight, but in a number of other passages as well. I didn't think we had time to read everything on it. What we know about him, it's a dude. He's human. The voice, remember, the voice of the eyes and the voice of a man. Might be indwelt by Satan. It's himself. It looks like he is. Definitely gets his power from Satan. He's directed by Satan. He arises from within a powerful ten-nation entity that is related somehow to ancient Rome. It's probably, according to Daniel 9, it's the people of the prince who is to come. It's the people, not the geography. In all likelihood, it would be the people and cultural heritage of Rome, which would basically be Europe. But it would also be countries like us. Could be in this. The U.S., Canada, Australia, other languages that were European, or European heritage. Who knows? But there are 10 nations at the center, at the hub, that are kind of calling shots. He has more military power than anyone else on earth, and some sort of a Western coalition like that would certainly fit that description. Wins a worldwide following, for finally, the dream is realized. What Napoleon wanted, what Hitler wanted, what the Romans wanted. Worldwide rule finally happens. Literally, because it says every nation, every tribe, every tongue, and every people. Four ways of saying everybody minus nobody will follow this guy. And, you know, that's emphasis. It's basically saying, no kidding, it's really the whole world. It happens during the tribulation. These events are clearly linked to the tribulation based on that 3.5 year number coming up again. That's been a consistent clue that these are all talking in the same time periods. And, of course, the second coming of Christ places it in the tribulation as well. He's the one that commits what Jesus and Daniel called the abomination of desolation, where he defiles the temple. Paul says he goes into the temple and claims that he's God. And that's maybe what we read about later in this chapter, too, with the image of the beast. He persecutes the people of God ruthlessly. He makes it illegal to not follow him, and then finally is destroyed by Jesus and flipped into the lake of fire. Okay, there's your career of the beast. Does some other things too. Let's keep reading Revelation 13. Anyone with ears to hear should listen and understand. Anyone who is destined for prison, he'll be taken to prison. Anyone who's destined to die by the sword is going to die by the sword. This means that God's holy people must endure persecution patiently and remain faithful. I think it's just saying, you know, you're not going to be able to avoid this. It's worldwide, and what, you know, it's coming down, and it's not going to be a good time. Then I saw another beast come up out of the earth. So here's our third beast. Later in the book of Revelation, it refers to this third beast as the false prophet. There's the beast and the false, his name changes to the false prophet. But you can see how they got that. He has two horns like those of a lamb, but he spoke with the voice of a dragon. So outwardly he looks all, you know, humble and meek like a little lammy. But then he opens his mouth. It's the dragon. He's working for the same side. He exercised all the authority of the first beast, and he required all the earth and its people to worship the first beast whose fatal wound had been healed. He did astounding miracles, even making fire flash down to earth from the sky while everyone was watching. And with all the miracles he was allowed to perform on behalf of the first beast, he deceived the people who belonged to the world. Paul and Jesus say the same thing. False miracles are going to be coming out of this crew, and people are going to sucker for it. They're going to think, well, that's supernatural, you know, and they're going to believe. It's deceiving. Telling those people who dwell on the earth to make an image of the beast, not a statue. If you have NLT, they put in the word big statue for this. And the word icon is an image. It's not a statue. It could be a picture. It could be a screen. It's not necessarily it could be a sculpture, but probably not. Wait. Did I finish reading that? Image of the beast who had the wound of the sword, yes, and come to life. He was then permitted to give life to this image so that it could speak and cause as many who do not worship the image of the beast to be killed. This might be, I don't know where this image is located. I wonder if it's in the temple. He required everyone, the small, the great, the rich and the poor, the free and the slave, to be given a mark on the right hand or on the forehead. And no one could buy or sell anything without that mark, which was either the name of the beast or the number representing his name. And he says, wisdom is needed here. Let the one with understanding solve the meaning of the number of the beast, for it is the number of a man, and his number is 666. Dun, dun, dun. So here is the omen. Here's all of the, you know, the 666, kind of famous. No one knows what it means to this day. I take it when we get closer to these events, you know, when it's relevant, this number will become apparent what it means. But it's also clear that it's not right out there, 666, on somebody's forehead. You have to determine, you have to discern and interpret the 666. One theory is that, you know, in biblical kind of use of numbers, six usually stands for man because he was created on the sixth day. It's also less than God's number, which is seven. But the number for God is seven, and it's also three because of the Trinity. And here might be man, acting as the Trinity, acting as God, man trying to be God, which would kind of fit some things and stuff, but I don't know whether they would have gotten that or not. We made it. We're 313. But we need to think about this a little bit more. Okay, so what we're being told is that in the course of history, as history reaches its climax, there's going to be this one world thing that's going to be happening. First of all, there's several claims made here. One is that an empire resembling ancient Rome is going to reappear. The fatal head wound being healed. How crazy is that to think that an extinct ancient empire could reappear in modern or future times? It's obviously not here yet. But it is kind of interesting, I think, to consider the European Union. Here was a situation where when the treaty was signed, forming the European Union, it's called the Treaty of Rome, signed in 1957. People before that time, you know, throughout history, Europeans have done nothing but fight with each other and have wars. And one of the things that affected European thinking in the formation of this treaty to try to become a United States of Europe was World War II. They basically, you know, realize this is stupid. We've got to quit doing this. We need to unify And another crucial piece of their thinking was envy of the United States. They could see here the U.S., you know, is unified between all the states, many of which are just as big as the European states, and the U.S. was going berserk with wealth and productivity and just not having any of the problems, that they could see that they were at a competitive disadvantage because, you know, just crossing a border in Europe, you had to change your currency, you had to get out your passport, you sit in line, you know, it was an hour or two ordeal just to go from Germany into France or whatever. And so this treaty was to unify Europe. That was succeeded by a second treaty, the Maastricht Treaty in 1991. The Maastricht Treaty is very specific, that it's called the Treaty on European Union, represents, and this is from the Eurozone, the EU's website, which is called Europa. You can Google this up and read, you can actually read these treaties in full text. Their summary of it says, the Treaty on European Union represents a new stage in European integration since it opens the way to political integration. It creates a European Union consisting of three pillars: the European communities, the common foreign and security policy, and a police and judicial cooperation in criminal matters. So you have now a court system for the EU. You have a parliament. You have a president, a parliament that's selected by the countries, by the people in Europe. They form a common foreign policy together. Today, anywhere you drive in Europe, you just, you know, the border between Belgium and France is just like between Ohio and Indiana. It's just like there's a sign. That's it. Everyone uses the same money. It's completely different than it used to be. And kind of interesting. The treaty introduces the concept of European citizenship. It reinforces the powers of the European Parliament, and it launches economic and monetary union. And the Lisbon Treaty has further strengthened the European Union's Parliament and given them more powers. They tried to pass a constitution for Europe, which failed, but there's still talk about rolling it back out again with some changes. This progress has been painfully slow. I started hearing that Europe was going to unify and form a new revised version of the ancient Roman Empire in the 1960s, when no one hardly ever heard of it. It was nothing. And the progress has been agonizingly slow, but always in the same direction, always toward the goal of unification. This could be the kernel of that future power. It's not very implausible when you see this super implausible thing happening. You know, if you were in the 1800s and said, you know, European countries are all going to unite into a United States of Europe, you'd be like, that's crazy. That'll never happen. They hate each other. It's happening. The Bible says it's going to happen. What about this one? 13:7, authority over every tribe, people, tongue, and nation was given to him. One world government. How far-fetched is that? That sounds really hard to accept. The way I like to look at this is, first of all, what would it take for that to even be possible? It's never been possible before. It certainly couldn't have happened in the times of John. It took up to 3 months just to get across the Roman Empire, and that was like a tenth of the world. You know, so I mean, how could they ever, not, you know, rule everywhere on earth, let alone control whether they can buy or sell anything? What we read there, there's no way they could do that. But now we come up whoop into the modern era. We start to ask ourselves, why would nations agree to come under this one world government? Well, one requirement would be global communications. You would have to be able to be in pretty much instant touch with anywhere in the world in order to, in practical terms, to really, you know, govern something the size of the world. And, you know, we don't really need to say much about this. Walter Wriston, in his book, The The Twilight of Sovereignty, where he argues that national entities are losing their power and say physical borders don't really mean that much in today's world because everything soars around the world without boundaries. And it's taking the say-so away from national governments. He says the single most powerful development in global communities has been the satellite. Satellites now bind the world, for better or worse, in an electronic infrastructure that carries news, money, and data anywhere on the planet at the speed of light. Satellites have made borders utterly porous to information. This was a radical, dramatic change. You know, the fact that I was just talking to somebody in Europe the other day, you know, with their face on my laptop, and speaking to one another. It's nothing, you know, push a button, and you're all of a sudden talking to someone on the other side of the world. Wow! They used to dream about stuff like that. It's commonplace now. You would have to have a global economy. If the world's economy, instead of the economy of the U.S., you know, Britain, Argentina, China, and so forth, if it all became one economy, then that would create a logic of also having one government. This too is happening as we watch today. Globalization. Riston says the world can no longer be understood as a collection of national economies. The electronic infrastructure that now ties the world together, as well as the great advances in the efficiency of conventional transportation, are creating a single global economy. He says, as global business alliances grow and strengthen over time, it will become harder and harder for politicians to unscramble the emerging global economy and to reassert their declining power to regulate national life. I think you can see what he's saying. You know, if it used to be, and this still occasionally happens, where a government would be like, okay, our currency is worth this many dollars per cruzeiro, like they did in Brazil. And they could just, as a government, just say, this is how much our currency is worth. You can't do that anymore, because the world will tell you what your currency is worth. The international monetary markets basically determine what's worth what, and you cannot just I remember when the Brazilians said, you know, set a price where, you know, the computers would cost $4,000 each. So, you know, you just don't see that kind of thing. The Chinese still try to do that. They're one of the few that have that kind of control still. They're breaking down. Probably one of the last really controlled economies is Cuba. And they've tried to go to it in Argentina, and with disastrous results, their economy is in free fall. People realize this. Basically, you've got to get in with this worldwide global market, or you're going to be left behind. That's all there is to it. The influence of Influence of the Largest 100 Economic Entities on Earth. Of the world's 100 largest economic entities in 2009, 44 are corporations, not even countries, but corporations that have more assets and money than entire countries. If you look at the top 150 economic entities, the proportion of corporations rises to almost 60% in 69. 60% of the top 150 economic entities are companies, and they're all multinational, diversified in countries all around the world. They don't have a loyalty to a particular country at all. Their loyalty is to the flow of goods, money, and services, making profit. IMF is the International Monetary Fund. In their magazine, Friedman, who's a pretty good writer from the New York Times, was talking about his book about this that came out in 2004 called The Flat Earth. But he says that when he was writing that, he says the world has gone from connected to hyper-connected in the space of a decade, 10 years. Stiglitz, in his book on globalization, says, in effect, economic globalization has outpaced political globalization. We have a chaotic, uncoordinated system of global governance without global government. So it's creating a vacuum. You have a global economy, but national governments. There's a contradiction there that people see. And so basically it's just anarchy out on the global marketplace, and there's a cry to gain control. IMF goes, Friedman goes on, he says, in 2003, when he wrote his book, as he was writing his book, he says, Facebook didn't exist. Twitter was still a sound. The cloud was still in the sky. 4G was a parking space. LinkedIn was a prison. And an application was what you sent to college. Big data was a rap star, and Skype was a typo. Think about that. 2003, that's not that long ago. I remember 2003. Third thing we would need would be a global consensus. People would have to come to a much higher level of agreement about some basic values. And we're going to just wait and talk about that when we get to chapter 17, because Revelation says that's exactly what's going to happen. Finally, you would have to have that incredible ability to have global control. Think of that passage that we read, that the false prophet makes everyone have a mark of some sort, and they cannot buy anything or sell anything without that mark. How do you do that? And think of it from an ancient writer's perspective. You know, even inside of the Roman Empire, they never had that level of control. Good Lord. People in the village could do anything they want. But they're saying, no. The rich and the poor, slave, every nation, tribe, tongue, and language, nobody will be able to buy or sell without that mark. And it's a number. What good would they think that it would do to put a mark or a number on people? How does that help you control what they're doing? Well, that's not so mysterious to modern readers. We're reading that and we're thinking, yeah. Let's read CNET News just this week, last week. How Big Brother is going to peek into your connected home. They say the security and privacy issues that play in haphazardly wiring up our personal spaces are becoming increasingly more substantive, and with the proliferation of smart devices, opening up our lives to more points of vulnerability. There have been nearly 600 million breaches of records since 2005. So there's this huge problem. We're all interconnected. We're all in the cloud. We've got our smart apps and phones and so forth. And you are accessible through every one of those. So it raises the specter of crime. It raises the specter of loss of privacy. A government would know whether you were buying or selling something. Yes, they could know that. And also, criminals could come and take all your money. I had just happened to have been hacked. I was in on the Target hack that just happened a month ago. 110 million customers had their material turned over to somebody in the Russian mob. And, my bank made me get a new credit card with a new number. I had to go to every account that I'm in and all my automatic payments and re-enter that. It took, hours of wasted time. So that was a real piss off. It would have been a lot worse if they had gotten all my money too. That didn't happen, but it could have. A lot of people have been nailed for a lot of money in that crime. Those are just the reported ones, said Will Pelgrim, president and CEO of the Center for Internet Security. It's almost a rite of passage of going through a data breach. I don't know anyone who hasn't been affected, whether it's email or the Target breach. The hackers out there are trying to harvest this data, or potentially in countries that don't prohibit it, and they have a lot of time, and some are well-funded. The fact that when I'm sitting in front of my computer, Google more or less knows what I'm doing, that doesn't seem to bother people too much, said an Apple executive. It's true. We all know that they know where we are, and they know what we're doing, and nobody seems to care. But think about it, think about it in light of this prophecy, which basically predicts that the beast is going to know whether you try to buy or sell anything. It's going to have that ability. Everyone. That would take an incredible system to pull that off, but that system is at hand. It's still under construction, but it is basically at hand today. USA Today. Credit card data theft is exploding, increasing 50% from 05 to 10, according to the latest figures from U.S. Department of Justice. This is unacceptable. This identity theft thing is a complete threat to the functioning of a global marketplace and the information revolution. It's got to be stopped. You have to be able to know when you're on a computer that the entity on the other side is actually who they say they are. How do you know that? Got to have an identity that's provable. Identity theft, defined as successful or attempted misuse of credit card, bank account, or other personal information to commit fraud, is expected to surpass traditional theft as the leading form of property crime. Security analysts say that everyone should prepare to become a victim at some point. So this is just like an upward soaring line on the graph that's going to bypass regular, you know, getting breaking into your house and stealing something or shoplifting and anything like that. It's going to be dwarfed by identity theft. Very hard to solve these crimes because you can't even tell where it's coming from half the time. Here's an article about India. Their vaunted tech savvy is being put to the test this week as the country embarks on a daunting mission, assigning a unique 12-digit number to each of its 1.2 billion people. The project, which seeks to collect fingerprint and iris scans from all residents and store them in a massive central database of unique IDs, every person in the country. So when you come to a transaction or to a situation needing a verification of identity, you have your number, and if that number matches the retinal scan or the fingerprint, then you've proven that you are the identity, that's you. Sure, someone could steal your number, but they would have the wrong retina to go with that number. This is high-level identity proof. They quote an Indian businessman who travels a lot. He says, "This will help me to prove my identity wherever I roam." Yes, it would. And this would solve so many problems if you could just have a fixed, provable identity for everyone on earth. Then when a crime occurred, you would know who did it. Control, high level of control needed. Here, another article from USA Today. Other types of identity thefts, including the filing of fraudulent tax claims, are growing fast. Child identity theft, where people steal the identity of a kid, and the kid never even finds out about it until they go to college or something and try to apply, and they're like, you got a balance of $20,000 debt, and you don't qualify. It's often impossible to locate the perpetrators of identity-related crimes, which makes them among the most difficult to solve. This is a huge problem standing in the way of progressing toward what everyone wants, that global successful marketplace. Here's a Congressional Research Service paper. They say an increase in globalization and a lack of cyber borders provides an environment ripe for identity thieves to operate from within the nation's borders as well as from without. So when we see, do we see a level of control like what's described in Revelation? No. But what we do see is the crying need for it. We see a vacuum longing to be filled. And so it's not too far out. I don't think, you know, when rich people start losing billions, they find things to do. The wealthy are not just going to give up their money to criminals. Here's something important to think about with this. What we're looking at here is not a one-world government, but we're looking at the necessary preconditions, the underlying structure of what would be needed in order to have something like that. Every one of these are coming into place as we watch, year by year, at a very rapid rate. And, just as important, none of them have ever been seen before our day. Now, so much for the argument, oh, they thought the world was going to end in 1,000. You know, they keep saying that. Everyone always saying the world's going to end, so, you know, just forget that whole notion. Yeah? Well, there's never been anything like this. This is absolutely unique to our day, to no other day. And so we have an incredible plausibility. We see that we're not reading this into an isolated passage, but we see the correlating passages all confirming what we're reading, and then also happening to line up with the course of history. One final point. Back to the Trinity of Hell. When we compare the Trinity of Hell to the real Trinity, it's interesting that it's not just that there's three of them, but they actually serve a similar function. In the real Trinity, God the Father is seen as the source of authority, the power. In the Trinity of Hell, Satan fills that role. The beast from the sea is Satan in human form, with a human body, even as the Son was God incarnated into flesh. The Son, Jesus, came to reveal God to us, and God coming here in person so he could get his message directly to us and also take care of the business of forgiving human sin. It was necessary that Jesus be incarnated, God in human form, so that he could die and pay for sin, not just for himself, but for everyone. That required an infinite being. The Holy Spirit, according to Jesus, he says he will not glorify himself, but he will take of mine and disclose it to you. The Holy Spirit is the revealer and the interpreter of Jesus, and he calls everybody's attention to Jesus and the need to have Jesus in your life. The false prophet is exactly the same way. It says his basic mission is to get everybody to worship the beast. So it's uncanny that this Trinity of Hell, not only superficially, but even in their function, kind of matches the real Trinity. And so we reach this ironic point where the entire world is actually worshiping Satan. They probably don't know that. I doubt they're going to know that. And yet this is what it's going to be. Something that he's longed for, I guess, for a long time. Okay, so we made it through 13. Next time we're going to go and read about these so-called bowls that are poured out, and it leads up to the Battle of Armageddon itself. We're right up to the absolute edge of the tribulation. Okay, well, we went kind of long, so why don't we just pray to it? Yeah, God, when we read your word and start to see and sense how you have foreseen everything coming, we start to realize it gives us a different view of the whole Bible. And we start to realize this truly is your word. It is truth. And we pray, God, that that realization will penetrate, that we will see the implications of it, and that we will, you know, devote ourselves to studying and learning what your word teaches. We thank you for the great and awesome message of the rescue of Jesus Christ, and that we can come to you and be with you, and that we don't have to worry about falling short of your righteous standards because he paid our price and for us. And we thank you that you're going to rescue the world when you come back. We're looking forward to that. In Jesus' name, amen.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.